Well, good morning.
Good morning.
We are now back after a layoff for summer vacation. I've been reading as much stuff as I've had time to read to kind of prepare in advance for trying to get this finished. And I just want to give you an update. When we last met, I said that the class was going to be 11 more lessons and that it was going to be designed to fit the third year of grade school, the Bible, and that sort of thing. That's not going to happen. It's going to be more than 11 lessons. Okay? There's just too much stuff that I can't cut out. I'd rather go for completeness to make sure that we get all the material in it that we need.
Hey Brian,
yeah.
Can I check to make sure this is recorded?
Sure.
I'm seeing something happen that doesn't usually happen.
Okay. Well, while he's doing that, I'm just going to talk about just a few general things before I start the lesson. So next Sunday is the Bible conference, and the 9 o'clock hour, we're not going to be in here. We're going to be in the auditorium. There's going to be a conference study going on. But I am considering that 9 o'clock study the next church history class. Okay? Because I'm going to be teaching on the King James Bible and the historical impact of the King James Bible. And so that's going to be the next class, even though it's going to be added in as lesson 37 is what I'm saying. Okay? So we will still have in a different manner the class, but it'll just be down there next Sunday morning at 9 o'clock. We good? Norm?
Yeah, let me just back up just to make sure if you don't care, because I should have a light on this thing. There it goes. There it goes. It's the first time.
All right, well, we're good then?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, where we left off before was we were in the middle of the Reformation, and the last lesson I taught, lesson 35, was on the Anabaptists and the so-called radical reformers, all right? We're going to pick it up as if we never had a break with finishing up things about the Reformation, all right? And then we're going to move on from there and work towards where we are today. Now, as we do that, I'm going to be giving specific attention to the history of how we got to be where we're at as far as mid-acts, Pauline dispensationalism, and where it came from and how it developed and those sorts of things. But this morning our goal is to talk about the English Reformation. All right, so we're picking up sort of with where we left off. Now, point number one. From the times of John Wycliffe, the great English reformer, the Lord preserved a remnant in England who witnessed for the truth, who testified against the doctrines and superstitions of Rome. We found many of their descendants. We found many of the descendants of the Lollards or followers of Wycliffe in the western districts of Scotland, who were prepared to receive the new doctrines of the continual continental divines. That's just this author's way of referring to the reformers. Okay, so it was in England. There were many, very many, among the humbler classes who still held to the doctrines taught by their great chief, but they were compelled to hide themselves among the humbler ranks of people and to hold meetings in secret. We talked about John Wycliffe, okay? We talked about his career. We talked about his Bible translation, his doctrine and his theology as a reformer, and how the Lollards were the followers of Wycliffe, who not only continued the translation process and continued to refine Wycliffe's translation, but also were preaching justification by grace through faith that Wycliffe was teaching and so forth. So even though Wycliffe is killed and his bones are exhumed and they're burned and his ashes are thrown in the river and all those things that we studied, there was still a remnant of people, of those Lollards, that existed in England from the time of John Wycliffe all the way through until the times we're going to be discussing today in the early 1500s with Henry VIII. E.H. Broadbent, author of The Pilgrim Church, concurs with Miller's assessment. Broadbent states that the Lollard movement was outwardly suppressed, there were always remains of it, and from the time to time, persons were punished for meeting together to read the scriptures. So again, we see that these guys have to go underground, alright? The church authorities of the Roman system that are having authority at the time don't want these guys propagating the English Bible. They don't want them teaching the English Bible in the language of the people, and so these people are forced to meet in secret and so forth, and any time their whereabouts or their activities were made known, they always would face persecution. To prove this, Miller offers the account of the burning of six men and women in Coventry in 1519 for teaching their children the Lord's Prayer, the Ten Commandments, and the Apostles' Creed in the vernacular language. Okay? So here again is an example of the Roman church authorities persecuting and executing people who were involved in memorizing, teaching, or studying the Bible or any religious documents in the native language or the vernacular language, in this case, English. All right. Church historian Kenneth Scott Lorette reports Lowardry had never completely died out. It persisted chiefly among the poor and often in outward conformity with the church. Translations of the Bible existed in English and were read, although not by any means as widely as after the invention of printing. Recall, if you will, that Wycliffe makes his translation before the invention of the printing press. So all of it, the early copies, all have to be transcribed and copied and written by hand. Okay? And I don't remember the exact number off the top of my head, but there are somewhere in it up above 300 of these Wycliffe Bibles that still exist that we know of today that have been documented by historians as being authentic Wycliffe Bibles that are still in existence and have survived down through our time despite the persecution of the church against the Lollards and against those that were advocating for the English Bible. Now, so John Wycliffe had opened up a soil, if you will, in England, okay? And it had never, the Catholic Church had never succeeded in totally stamping out the witness of the Lollards and of these people that were in line with John Wycliffe. So into that sort of soil, that fallow ground, the writings of Luther would certainly find fruitage. They were not long in reaching Oxford and Cambridge. In Cambridge especially, they awakened interest. Here was a circle whose members, aided by the Greek New Testament of Erasmus, were earnestly studying the Scriptures. Thomas Blaney and Hugh Latimer were Cambridge men who embraced the writings of Luther and were later burnt at the stake as heretics. Okay? So into that soil, the writings of Luther are going to come over from the continent. And there are going to be scholars and men at Cambridge and also at Oxford that are going to begin to read Luther, and the ideas of Luther are going to start to take root in some of these people that are at Cambridge and Oxford. There are two mentioned there for you specifically who are going to be burned at the stake by the Catholic Church as heretics for supporting and teaching justification by faith and other doctrines that Luther taught. Now, William Tyndale, okay? Tyndale is going to be born into this situation. Tyndale was born in 1494 to a prosperous yeoman family not far from Gloucestershire. He took a degree at Oxford and later studied at Cambridge. At some point, Tyndale was ordained into the church, the Catholic Church, although we don't know when exactly that was. While at Cambridge, Tyndale fell in love with Greek and the words of Renaissance humanist Erasmus. After he completed his studies, Tyndale became the chaplain of a wealthy family. At a banquet, Tyndale and a priest debated the meaning of Scripture. Tradition reports that the priest as having said, it would be better to be without God's law than the Pope's. So Tyndale gets into this. Tyndale is educated, he's exposed to Erasmus, the Greek New Testament. At Cambridge and Oxford, he's exposed to the teachings and the writings of Luther. He becomes a priest, and becomes ordained, and then he's hired as a private chaplain for this family. And according to the tradition as we know it, he gets in this argument or this debate with this priest, and the priest tells him that, hey, we'd be better without God's law than the Pope's. Now, those of you that have been part of the class from the beginning, should that come of any surprise to you, the attitude of the Catholic Church toward its own canon laws? Okay? To which Tyndale retorted, if God spares my life, before many years pass, I will make it possible for the boy behind the plow to know more Scripture than you do. Okay? So, Tyndale is very much, he knows Greek, he's familiar with Erasmus, he's familiar with the teachings of Luther and so on. Okay? Unfortunately for Tyndale, the devout Catholic, Henry VIII, had occupied the throne of England since 1509. In 1520 or 21, depending on what sources you read, okay, Henry or someone from his court, probably Sir Thomas More, wrote a stinging tract against one of Luther's ideas. In recognition of Henry's support, the Pope gave him the title Defender of the Faith. Okay? Now, Henry VIII, the guy that's going to be the catalyst for the breaking away of England from the Catholic Church, initially is as devout a Catholic as you're going to find. Okay? When Luther's writings first are coming out, Henry VIII writes or has someone else write and advocates against the Pope, or against Luther, I'm sorry, and the Pope at the time is going to confer on to Henry VIII the title of Defender of the Faith for writing this tract and this treatise against the teachings of Luther. Okay? So, Henry VIII being a good Catholic, he's going to follow the party line. Alright? Following the Catholic party line, Tyndale's bishop refused to let him translate the Greek New Testament into simple English. In response, Tyndale fled to the German provinces where he could work on the translation without interference. Alright? So, understand what's going on. Tyndale wants to translate. The Catholic authorities, all the way up to as high ranking as the king and the bishops, are not going to allow him to do this. So the only place that he's going to be able to do this in any kind of relative safety is if he flees England and goes to the continent. And so he is going to settle, at least for a while, in the German provinces. Now, just think about it. Why would he pick Germany? Because of Luther, okay? There's safe havens in certain parts of Germany for him to go and, in relative security, work on this translation of the Bible into English, okay? Now, I should tell you, Wycliffe did translate the Bible before Tyndale, but remember that Wycliffe's translation was of the Latin Vulgate into English, okay? Tyndale is going to be the first guy to translate from the Greek into English, okay? I did a study. There's actually a blog entry up right now on my Defense and Confirmation blog about Wycliffe and the Morning Star of the Reformation. If you want to check it out, I have documented 20 verses that prove that Wycliffe was translating from the Vulgate and not from the Greek text. Because the Wycliffe translation matches the Latin Vulgate translation and the modern versions that you buy in the store today, which are coming from that Roman Catholic text line, which we'll learn more about next weekend at the conference. Okay, but Tyndale is the first guy to translate the Greek New Testament into English. All right, and he's going to do the same thing that Luther did. He's going to translate Erasmus's Greek New Testament into the everyday vernacular English of the people. All right, and he's going to do it on the continent in Germany. Tyndale arrived in Hamburg, Germany, in the midst of Luther's Reformation in May 1524. People were even reading the Bible in the German language, followed by theological discussion of the current issues of the day. This is a massive contrast to what's going on still in England. Okay? In England, the church still has pretty much absolute authority over religious matters, while all this is going on in Germany. Okay. Some zealous scholars, fearful that Tyndale may have leaned too heavily on Luther, deny that Tyndale ever met him. However, little question remains among most scholars that Tyndale did visit Luther in Wittenberg. It was while living in Wittenberg, where the university provided all the necessary scholarly tools, that Tyndale translated all or most of the New Testament. Tyndale certainly consulted the New Testament Luther had translated into German. That does not follow, however, that Tyndale's New Testament was an English translation of Luther's German New Testament. Tyndale was probably more competent in Greek and Hebrew than Luther, and his German was limited. Okay? There's pretty much no doubt that Tyndale knew Luther, or at least met him. Okay? Remember that it's the chapel in Wittenberg that Luther nailed the 95 Theses to the door of. So here's Tyndale now in exile, if you will, in Germany, in Wittenberg with access to the same resources of the university that Luther had, and he's working on this translation of the Bible into English. Okay? In August 5th, this is a picture, by the way, of a Tyndale page. In August 1525, Tyndale settled in the German city of Cologne with his new assistant, William Roy. The translation of the New Testament into English was complete. The task was now to ensure its printing and distribution. They chose to produce the work in the printing house of a guy named Peter Quintel. Quintel. All right? Any questions so far, by the way?
Who's the Jones that you're quoting here?
Timothy Paul Jones. He's the author of Christian History Made Simple. However, at Quintel's Press, we're also producing the works of Johannes Cochlius, that's how I'm going to say it. You know, if you ever disagree with me about the names, you're wrong because I'm teaching and I get to say them how I want. Okay? A noted opponent of Luther who happened to learn of Tyndale's project. So, the press that Tyndale picks to print the Bible on is also printing the works of this opponent of Luther who finds out that this printer is going to be printing Tyndale's Bible. Okay? It seems that some of Quintel's printers became drunk in a public tavern one evening and let slip that thousands of Lutheran New Testaments were being produced in English right under the noses of the Catholic authorities. Word of this soon reached this guy, who was no fool and could see his star rising in the German Catholic firmament if he were to expose and block this project. So what he does is he arranges for a raid on this guy's presses. Alright? Tyndale and Royal, however, managed to escape and salvage at least some of their printing, along with the text of the translation. Undeterred, they moved their printing operation further up the Rhine to the city of Worms and began the tedious process all over again using the press, this time of a guy named Michael Schoffer, or Schoffer. Okay? So, they sniffed out. They're able to salvage the entire text of the translation and about 80 printed pages that had came off that first printing of that press. Okay? Any questions? And so then they move up the Rhine and they move to another city and they're going to start the whole thing over again now using a different press. Any questions about any of this so far? No, I just read it wrong.
How about a comment?
Mm-hmm.
My mom and dad went to Germany and were taken to the city of Worms and shown in one of the churches the Baptist records of baptisms. And Lionheart Chrysler was there in Worms at that time.
So that's a relative of yours? Is that a relative of yours?
Yeah,
oh,
absolutely. And
that's cool.
I'm just really excited to know he was there when this was going on.
Hey, this would have been an extremely exciting time to be alive. Okay? A lot of stuff is happening at this time in history. Now, it was long believed that all the original text printed in Cologne had been lost. All right? However, in 1834, 8 of these original sheets were discovered bound into another work. These sheets help us to gauge the influence of Luther upon Tyndale's work. So let me explain what's going on there. When they run out of Cologne, rescuing their materials before the Catholics raid the press, okay, they take about 80 pages of the original printing that they started of the Book of Matthew. Until 1834, it was believed that all of those original pages were lost until somebody found them bound within another book, okay, and realized what they were. Alright? So what you can do then is, what they've done is they've taken those pages, there's only 8 of them, so it's not a lot of them, but those 8 pages are enough to give insights into how much Luther and Luther's German Bible influenced what Tyndale was doing with his English translation. Okay? So that's what these 3 points are looking at. Okay?
You said a minute ago 80 pages.
There were 80 total pages.
And then you said 8.
And there are only 8 that they found bound in this other book in 1834. Okay? So there were 80, they believe there are 80 total pages rescued that they thought all of which were lost until 1834 when they found 8 of them bound in this other book and figured out what they were. They were just miscellaneously put in this other thing. Alright? And you know, you say, well, why would that be the case? While I honestly can't totally answer that, it's obviously something somebody did, knowing what they had, to hide what they, to have to hide it. Okay? So if you take those 8 pages and you compare them to a Luther Bible, we can look at the following 3 trends and comparisons between Tyndale and between Luther. Okay? So number 1, the pages included a prologue, which is dependent upon, at points, upon Luther's own prologue to his 1522 German New Testament. Alright? This was not included in the 1526 printing. So when the entire Tyndale New Testament was printed, this prologue that they found bound in this other book did not show up in the 1526 Tyndale New Testament. Okay? That's one way they know what they had when they discovered it in 1834. You following that? Number 2, the list of contents of the New Testament follows a convention that existed within Lutheran circles at this stage, which regarded 4 New Testament works, Hebrews, James, Jude, and Revelation, as being of dubious authority. These were placed at the end of the contents and are not numbered. Tyndale appears to have been obliged to follow this convention by Peter Quantel himself. However, again, the 1526 printing abandoned this convention. Okay? So we see that Tyndale had things set up a certain way that was very similar to Luther in these pages that were part of this original printing on that press that got raided, but when you compare them to the complete 1526 New Testament that was actually done, they're not there. But it tells you that that Tyndale had direct contact and was influenced by who? Luther. Okay? And third, the 1525 printing included marginal notes. The pages that have survived included 90 such notes, suggesting that Tyndale envisioned a high level of comment on the text throughout the New Testament. The general style and tone of these notes is Lutheran. Some are cribs of Luther's own notes. However, there are no such notes in the 1526 edition. So it's clear when you make these comparisons, there is no doubt that Tyndale was influenced or had direct contact with who? Luther. In fact, it's probably fairly reasonable to assume that that was the case. He was in Worms. He was in Wittenberg. I'm sorry. He was doing the translation. When you look at how he set up what he was originally going to print before it got raided, it is very, very similar to many of the ways that Luther was doing things at the time.
Translates
the Greek New Testament of Erasmus into German.
Into German, yes.
And then Tyndale is in exile under the reign of Henry VIII. He goes over to Germany to translate the Bible into English.
Okay.
Yep.
Question. Why, if he was following a lot of Lutheran ideas through there, why did he not include them in the 1526?
I think 2 reasons: time and money. It's going to take a lot more time to set up a printing with all these marginal notations and all this extra stuff in it, and it's going to cost more money than it is to just print the text. Okay.
Is there any Luther Bibles around?
Oh yeah. You mean Tyndale or Luther?
Well, Luther. Then.
Yeah, there's Luther Bibles that still exist.
Pastor?
Yeah.
Isn't it pretty good evidence for the doctrine of preservation when you realize that some of this stuff was lost, destroyed, and then just bits and pieces come back? How can we explain that except the providence and protection and preservation of God?
Certainly the believers knew what they had. And they were willing to do what needed to be done to make sure that it was preserved, including hiding it in other books and doing all sorts of things, you know, to dying for it in many cases, to preserve, you know, what they had, the witness and the life that they had. So, the first printed New Testament in English was completed at Worms in 1526. And it was a small octavo edition. Now, I'm not going to get into that. That's just talking about how big the pages are. Okay? There are different sizes of Bibles at the time, and that's just a reference to how big the pages were. But it was a relatively portable Bible. It probably would not have been as convenient as the one that you have, but by the standard of the day, it would have been fairly small and compact. All right. The difficulties and dangers involved in getting such volumes into England were almost as great as those which lay in the way of their distribution. The clergy opposed the new translation with all their might. Sir Thomas More was one who wrote violently against it. In October 1526, Bishop Tunstall, the champion defender of the Constitutions, just real quick, you remember that the Constitutions were documents that were drafted in the 1400s that said that outlawed and banned the translation of the Bible into English, unless without explicit permission from the church or the crown. We talked about that when we looked at Wycliffe, okay? So let me start that sentence over again. In October 1526, Bishop Tunstall, the champion defender of the Constitution, began confiscating the New Testaments as they were smuggled into England. Public burnings of copies and punishments of all offenders blackened the spirits of the masses. While on the continent, Tyndale moved further over to the Protestant position. In 1528, he issued the parable of wicked mammon, in which he came out flatly for justification by faith, and took over most of the texts of the sermon by Luther on the unjust steward. So the longer Tyndale is there, he is becoming increasingly more in favor of the Protestant position. All right. Now there are all kinds of stories about the distribution of the Bible. One of them includes the fact that it became known to Tyndale that the Catholics were sending spies over there to try to round up Bibles. So this one guy tips him off to this, and so he sells the guy the Bibles, knowing that it takes the money, knowing that they're going to be taken back to England and destroyed, so then he can take the money and make more Bibles. Okay, so there's all kinds of stories that are swirling even in history as you look back about how these Bibles were smuggled into England and how they were received. The Catholic Church hated them. They wanted to destroy them. They did everything they could to oppose them. But the everyday common man who could get their hands on one, that they loved the thing. Because they could do exactly what he said and read the Bible in their own language and understand it. Okay? All right, now, before we move on to Henry's break with Rome, are there any questions about Tyndale? All right. Henry VIII breaks with Rome. If the Lutheran Reformation began in a monastic cell, the Anabaptist Reformation in a prayer meeting, the Calvinist Reformation at a scholar's desk, then the English Reformation began in the affairs of state, specifically with the problem of success, or a successor, it should say, to the royal throne. Does Henry VIII give two hoots about the doctrine? No. What does he need? He needs a boy. He needs a clear successor to the throne of England. Okay? We've already looked at the fact that he writes this document, you know, attacking Luther, and he's given the title of Defender of the Faith by the Pope for it. Okay? So up until he has his own political crisis here, Henry VIII is a staunch Catholic. All right? Has no intention of leaving the church, is perfectly fine with it, with staying where he's at. In a sense, folks, England had two reformations. A constitutional one under King Henry VIII, and a theological one under the Puritans, almost a century later. Under Henry, nothing changed doctrinally. England simply rejected the authority of Rome. Succession to the throne was the primary constitutional factor in the transformation of England, of the Church of England, the church in England, sorry, into the church of England. Okay? Now, just a little bit of history on this. The schism in the church came over a royal problem, not over theological conflicts. Putting it simply, Henry VIII, King of England, revolted against the Pope because he passionately desired the dark-eyed Anne Boleyn, a lady-in-waiting of the court. But this is only the headline. The important facts surround the royal succession to the throne of England, not the personal lusts of the king. Henry knew how to satisfy his lusts. He shared the customary royal pastime of mistresses and had at least one illegitimate son. His problem was that he had no son born of his queen, Catherine of Aragon. Okay? So, you understand what's going on here. Can the king have whoever he wants to have in a physical way? Okay? That's not a problem. The problem is the only one that's going to be the heir is going to be born to the queen that he's married to. So he can have all the children he wants out of wedlock, but none of them are going to be what? King or heir to the throne. Okay? So Catherine, the daughter of Ferdinand and Isabella of Spain, these are the king and queen that sent out who? Columbus. Okay? So she is the daughter of Ferdinand and Isabella of Spain, had delivered five children. But the only survivor beyond infancy was Princess Mary. England was in no mood to accept a girl as heir to the throne because the nation's only previous queen had occasioned bloody wars of succession. So they had one experience up to this point with a queen, and it was nothing but constant warfare and fighting over who was really going to have what? The throne. Okay? Thus, as Catherine grew older, Henry grew more troubled over this. In 1525, the queen was 40, and Henry pondered more and more the ways of the Almighty. Am I under some curse of God? So his wife is getting to the age where she's no longer going to be able to have children. And what does he need in his mind? He needs a son. Okay? And he starts to wonder, am I under a curse? Well, why would he wonder that? The question arose prior to the marriage of Catherine. And here's why. Catherine had been Henry's deceased brother's wife. Okay? For at least several months. And Henry believed that the curse of God fell on any marriage to a brother's wife because of the verse in Leviticus that says, if any man take his brother's wife, it is an unclean thing, and so on. Okay? So he had questions about this before he married her. Alright? But, being the good Catholic that he is, he concedes to the Pope. Naturally, the church at Rome had also recognized the curse, and at this time, Naturally, the church of Rome had also recognized the curse, and at the time of Henry's wedding, Pope Julius II had found grounds for granting special permission for the wedding. But with the passing of the barren years, Henry wondered if Julius had not overstepped his sacred rights. Find what's going on here. Okay, and now there's no boy, and he's now thinking he's what? He's cursed. Okay? So, in 1527, Harry asked Holy Father Clement VII to revoke the special dispensation and declare the marriage of 18 years invalid from the outset. The Pope might have been open to the idea had not Catherine been the aunt of Charles V, Holy Roman Emperor and King of Spain. At the moment, the Pope could ill afford to offend the Emperor, so he stalled. Henry's personal reasons for desiring the annulment were matched by the Pope's political reasons for refusing the request. Now remember, folks, that Charles V is the Emperor, the Holy Roman Emperor over the German states, during the time of the Reformation. Now, the Pope is not going to allow this annulment because if he does, he's going to alienate his most powerful military and political ally on the continent if he allows Henry VIII to annul his marriage to this guy's aunt. Okay? So what the Pope does essentially is he stalls. He just sits on it and waits to see what's going to happen here. Okay? In the meantime, is Henry becoming more and more upset with this? The pace of negotiations between King Henry VIII of England and Pope Clement VII accelerated dramatically toward the end of 1532. Anne Boleyn, whom Henry wanted as his new wife to replace Catherine of Aragon, was pregnant. So now Henry has gone ahead and gotten her pregnant. If the child whom Henry desperately hoped would be a boy was to be legitimate and the recognized heir of the throne, Henry needed to marry Anne and to do so in a hurry. But still, the Pope was not consented to an annulment of Henry's marriage with Catherine. So, what's he going to do? The Pope's not going to grant an annulment. What's the only way around this? Get rid of the Pope. Okay? So, at an impasse, Henry took what seemed to be the only course open to him. If the Pope would not give him a divorce, he would find someone who would. If finding someone else to ratify the divorce meant that England's church must break from the universal Roman Catholic Church, then break it would. Okay? Henry's new Archbishop of Canterbury, Thomas Cranmer, was willing to ratify the divorce and marry Henry and Anne Boleyn without waiting for the Pope's permission. Even more important, Henry's Parliament, which had been in session, intermittently since 1529, was willing to enact the legal measures required to back up the Archbishop's actions. Shortly after Henry's marriage to Anne Boleyn in January 1533, Parliament took the next step of flatly prohibiting appeals of English church decisions to Rome. So this break with the church has nothing to do with doctrine. It has plain and simple everything to do with the political succession of the throne of England. Okay? The Pope won't grant the divorce, so Henry says, fine, I'll find someone who will. His new archbishop is willing to do it, and so he arranges for the thing, the Parliament is in agreement, and they go with it. Alright?
My eternal question is, does God have any place in doing this? I mean, it's looking out for England to become Protestant, but...
I don't think God's like... in Henry's bedchamber when he's shacking up with all of his illegitimate women and doing what he's doing.
So it could be awesome. I mean,
at what point did he get rid of Catherine?
Yeah.
Well, we're getting to that.
Why did he marry Catherine? Was that political too?
Political. Yeah.
So and
you got to remember that at this time, who's clearly the rising power? Not England.
Spain.
So a marriage to somebody from Spain is viewed as extremely politically expedient at the time when he does it. Okay, so there's a political reason why he marries her. And then, interestingly enough, it's because he marries her that the Pope won't annul the marriage. Because he doesn't want to ostracize Charles. Alright?
Solomon did the same thing
to him with all of
his wife.
Yeah, similar. Something got cut out here.
Did I go too far?
In 1534, Parliament took the final steps, okay, in what had become, it was basically inevitable that this was going to happen. It first decreed that church taxes formerly paid to Rome should go to the monarch. That's nice. Then passed an act of supremacy, which former altered the situation of the church in England. And this is a quotation from this act of supremacy. Albeit the King's Majesty justly and rightly is and oweth to be the supreme head of the Church of England. So, now who's the head of the Church in England? The King, not the Pope. So the King is creating his own religion now himself as the head of the Church. Alright? Being enacted by authority of this present Parliament that the King, our sovereign Lord, his heirs and successor, kings of this realm, shall be taken, accepted, and reputed the only supreme head on earth of the Church of England. It's pretty clear. Okay? Now, involved as the pros were, no one, then or now, mistook the consequences. England's church had broken from the Catholic Church. English church belonged to the English, or at least to the English king. For opposing this and similar moves, dedicated Catholics like Bishop John Fisher and Sir Thomas More would go to the block and be beheaded for it. For urging Henry on toward a more complete reformation, dedicated Protestants like Robert Burns and John Firth would also have their heads chopped off. Okay? So, Henry really doesn't care a whole lot about the doctrinal theological issues here. What he cares about is the what? The politics. Okay? The Catholics that are mad about it, he kills them. The Protestants that are just sitting there saying, oh yeah, well let's go a little bit further, they get it too. Okay? So, the sole religious issue in England's initial Reformation was papal supremacy. Henry intended no break with the old faith. He considered himself, in fact, a guardian of Catholic dogma. After the break with the Church, England's orthodoxy remained intact. Henry continued to insist upon Catholic doctrine within the realm. The Statute of the Six Articles in 1539 upon such Catholic articles such Catholic articles as clerical celibacy, the private mass, and confessions to a priest. Only two serious changes marked the new way within the Church of England. The first was the suppression of monasteries, and the second was the eventual publication of an English Bible for use in the churches. Other than that, the entire doctrine and system of the Church of England was 100% what? Roman Catholicism under a different name. Instead of the Pope being the head, the King being the head. Okay? Despite eventually allowing an English translation, early pioneers such as William Tyndale did not fare well under Henry's reign. In 1530, one of Tyndale's tracts denounced Henry's attempts to dispose of Catherine. And with the help of a spy sent from England, Tyndale was captured in Belgium in 1536. And after being held in prison for 17 months, Tyndale was strangled and his body was burned. And Tyndale's dying prayer was, Lord, open the eyes of the King of England. Okay? Now he's obviously referring to what? Specifically referring to the English Bible, but he's referring to the entire process of reform also. Okay? So, Tyndale's betrayed, caught, and executed for what he did in translating the Bible into English. Alright, so now Henry is broken from the church. What are the consequences of Henry's changes? Number one, Henry did not get the male heir, immediately get the male heir he saw. After Anne Boleyn gave birth to a daughter, Elizabeth, she fell out of Henry's favor. Okay? Eventually she was charged with treason, imprisoned in the Tower of London, and beheaded in 1536. So wifey number two doesn't give him a daughter, so he's got to do what? Get rid of her. Okay? So then, after that, almost at once, Henry took his third wife, Jane Seymour, and she gave him a son named Edward. And I think I might have messed this up. It should say, she gave him a son named Edward, but died 2 weeks after giving birth. So Jane Seymour gives birth to Edward, and 2 weeks after Edward is born, Jane Seymour dies. Okay? So now he has this male son, but no wife. You following that? Henry married three more times after that, and none of those marriages produced any children. Okay? So he's got how many kids now? Legitimate kids, I should say. He's got three. Okay? He's got Mary, his daughter from his first wife, Catherine of Aragon. He's got Elizabeth, his daughter from his second wife, Anne Boleyn. And he's got Edward now, third, the son that he wanted from his third wife, Jane Seymour. You following all that? It's like watching a soap. After Henry's death in 1547, each of his three children ruled England in turn. This created religious turmoil. Henry's son Edward became ruler when he was just 9 years old. Too young to rule, Edward VI was guided by adult advisors. These men were devout Protestants, and they introduced Protestant reforms into the English church. Almost constantly in ill health, Edward reigned for just 6 years. So he's going to die at, about 15 years old. He's going to die. Okay? So all this shenanigans that Henry's been trying to work the whole time to get his male heir, he only reigned 6 years. Alright? So Edward then is going to be followed by Mary the First. Okay? Mary, the daughter of Catherine of Aragon, took the throne in 1553. She now was a Catholic. So she's going to return the English church to the rule of the Pope. So all the stuff that happened under Henry and under Edward and any reforms that were made, Mary now takes the throne. And let's face it, is Mary quite bitter?
Oh, sure.
Oh, of course. And so she then takes England and puts them back officially under the Pope and tries to reinstitute Catholicism. All right? Let me get back to my point here. Her efforts met with considerable resistance, and she had many Protestants executed. That's where she gets her name, Bloody Mary, by the way. From the execution of all these Protestants that are protesting her putting England back under the authority of the Pope. Okay? When Mary died in 1558, Elizabeth now, Anne Boleyn's daughter, inherited the throne. Now, of the three, Edward, Mary, and Elizabeth, who was going to bring England into the golden light of the English Renaissance? It's going to be Elizabeth. You've heard of the Elizabethan Age, right?
Now, where's Elizabeth was beheaded in the tower?
That was her mommy, Anne Boleyn.
Oh, that was her mother.
That was her mother.
If
yeah.
It was just a kid that was like 4 years old, it was... Mm.
That was her mom. So under the reign of Elizabeth, the Spanish Armada is going to be defeated. Shakespeare is going to start his career. And world power is going to start shifting away from Spain into the hands of who? The English. Okay? So the reign of Elizabeth is highly significant in world history. Okay? But she is going to be the one that is going to sort of move England into England's golden age. England, Elizabeth I was determined to return her kingdom to Protestantism. In 1559, Parliament followed Elizabeth's wishes and set up the Church of England, or Anglican Church, with Elizabeth as its head. And this was to be, this was to be the only legal church in England. So now Elizabeth is going to move England back out of Catholicism and back into the Church of England. The Anglican Church is going to be set up. And then from there, they're never again going to go back to Catholicism. Okay, now are you following that? A lot of stuff to try to remember. So from then on, the only legal church in England at the time is going to be the Anglican Church, and Elizabeth, as the monarch, is the head of that church. Alright? Now, as far as some doctrinal things, Elizabeth decided to establish a state church that moderate Catholics and moderate Protestants might both accept. So what's she trying to do? She's trying to go down the middle here. Okay? To please Protestants, priests in England, in the Church of England, were allowed to marry. They could deliver sermons in English, not Latin. To please the Catholics, the Church of England kept some of the trappings of the Roman Catholic service and Mass. So Elizabeth is trying to do what? Sort of walk a middle road here and make as many people happy as she can. Yeah. And when James then is going to become king when Elizabeth dies. Okay? When James becomes king of England, he has already been king of Scotland for 15 or 16 years. That might not be the exact number of years, but he already has experience ruling when he becomes king of England upon the death of Elizabeth. Okay? And then from there, there's going to be a conference in the year 1604 called the Hampton Court Conference. James is on his way down from Scotland to take the throne. And before he even gets to London, there are already Puritans with a document badgering him to continue the reforms of the Reformation and take him further than Elizabeth wanted to take him.
Okay? What was James' relationship with Elizabeth?
I knew you were going to ask me that, and I know it, I just don't remember it. He's
how did he get to be king then?
He's a cousin or something of Elizabeth. He's younger than her, quite a bit younger than her, but he's a cousin, or he's somehow blood related to Elizabeth, and he's the only male, legitimate male heir in the line. So that's how he becomes the king of England. So then he becomes king of England and Scotland. Okay. Now what I've done here to end the lesson is I put together a little bit some information about the English Bible. Okay? So at the top it says, English Bibles produced during the reigns of English monarchs. Alright? So in the reign of Henry VIII, 1509 to 1547, you have Tyndale, Cloverdale, Matthew's Bible, and the Great Bible being translated and produced during the reign of King Henry VIII. Okay? Just a couple quick things. The Cloverdale Bible. Miles Cloverdale and John Rogers had remained loyal disciples of William Tyndale the last 6 years of Tyndale's life and carried the English Bible project forward after his death. Cloverdale finished translating the Old Testament and in 1535 printed the first complete Bible in the English language. Tyndale only produced the New Testament. Cloverdale produces the first complete English Bible, Old and New Testament. That's why he is significant. Okay, and that's done in 1535. And so that Bible was printed October 4th, 1535, and it's known as the Cloverdale Bible. Matthew's Bible. John Rogers went on to print a second complete English Bible in 1537. It was, however, the first English Bible translated totally from the original language of Hebrew and Greek, and it was printed under the pseudonym Thomas Matthew. As a considerable part of the Bible was a translation of Tyndale, it is a composite made up of Tyndale's Pentateuch and New Testament and Cloverdale's Bible as some of Roger's own translation of the text, and it went through a nearly identical second printing in 1549. And then finally, I made mention to the fact that eventually the king is going to allow an English Bible. Okay? And that's where you get the Great Bible of 1539. Thomas Cranmer, the Archbishop of Canterbury, hired Miles Cloverdale at the bequest of King Henry VIII to publish the Great Bible. It became the first English Bible authorized for public use, and it was distributed to every church and chained to the pulpit. And a reader was even provided so that the illiterate could hear the Word of God in plain English. Cranmer's Bible, published by Cloverdale, was known as the Great Bible due to its size. A large pulpit folio measuring over 14 inches tall. 7 editions of this were printed between April 1539 and December 1541. So these are the Bibles that are produced during the reign of King Henry, the English Bible during the reign of King Henry.
All of these Bibles contain 80 books, right? They contain the Apocrypha.
They do. Most of these are containing the apocryphal books. As far as I know, I might be wrong. I'd have to check. But so Edward he only reigned 6 years. No new translations are made. But during his reign, the Tyndale goes into 17 editions, Cloverdale goes into 3 editions, Matthew's 3 editions, and the Great Bible is going to be printed in 8 more editions. And this down here, by the way, this is a picture of the Great Bible. This thing is huge. And you see that this is chained here? This is chained to this podium so that you can't take it home with you. Okay? So this is an English Bible that was chained to the pulpit in every church. And by law, they had to allow for a reader to be present who could read it to anybody who was illiterate. Okay? So that's where it gets its name, the Great Bible. Mary the First. I already told you that Mary was a Catholic, better known as Bloody Mary. She persecutes the Protestants, okay? And so a group of English Protestants is going to flee to Geneva, Switzerland. And from Calvin's Geneva, they are going to translate the New Testament of the Geneva Bible in 1557. And if you look at your notes under Mary the First on page 7, it says the New Testament was completed in 1557 in Geneva, Switzerland by English Protestants seeking refuge from Bloody Mary's reign of terror. Mary had reinstituted Catholicism and persecuted the Protestants and their Bible. So the New Testament of the Geneva Bible is going to be produced in 1557. I do want to point something out. The Geneva Bible is famous for all these marginal notations. You see all this writing down the side? It is full of marginal notations. The Geneva Bible could be properly called the first study Bible ever printed. Okay? It is these marginal notations that King James hates with a passion, because they undermine the idea of the divine right of kings. Okay? So when James takes the throne and the question comes up about a new translation, James is willing to submit to that request because he hates the Geneva Bible's marginal notes. Okay? You following that? So that's under Mary. And then under Elizabeth, the Geneva Bible is going to be finished. The Old Testament is going to be finished. And so in 1560, the complete Bible is going to be published. And look at your notes on this. Due to the passage in Genesis describing the clothing that God fashioned for Adam and Eve upon expulsion from the Garden of Eden, they referred to them as breeches or britches. Some people refer to the Geneva Bible as the Britches Bible. The Geneva Bible is the first Bible to add numbered verses to the chapters. So before the Geneva Bible, you didn't have numbered verses like you have in your Bible. So it's the first Bible to do that, okay? It was the first Bible to add numbered verses to the chapters so that referencing specific passages would be easier. And every chapter was also accompanied by extensive marginal notes, like I showed you in that picture, and references. So throughout and complete, the Geneva Bible is considered the first English study Bible. William Shakespeare quotes hundreds of times in his plays from the Geneva translation of the Bible. And the Geneva Bible became the Bible of choice for over 100 years of English-speaking Christians. Between 1560 and 1644, at least 144 editions of this Bible were published. And the Geneva Bible remains over 90% of Tyndale's original English translation. In fact, the Geneva Bible remained the more popular, even more popular than the King James Version until decades after its release in 1611, and the Geneva Bible holds the honor of being the first Bible taken to America, or English Bible taken to America, and the Bible of the Puritans and the Pilgrims. So the Geneva Bible is definitely a significant Bible. And then lastly, the Bishop's Bible. The success of the Geneva Bible made it impossible to go on using the Great Bible for reading in church. Its deficiencies became all too obvious in the light of the new version. The Geneva, however, was too Calvinistic for the English clergy and was so popular among the lower classes that it was politically incorrect for public use in the pulpit. The Bishop's Bible thus came on the scene in 1568. It was a pulpit Bible, like the Great Bible. It was a big one. Based on the Great Bible, it was too wooden and pedestrian a translation. It would not compete with the Geneva Bible, and Queen Elizabeth never officially recognized the translation. It was called the Bishop's Bible because it was produced by bishops. All right, we have to quit. Sorry, after 10 o'clock.
I'll
They're extremely Calvinistic. You got to look at where the Bible was printed. It was put together in Geneva, the bastion of Calvinism, and many of the notes in the Geneva Bible are very heavily Calvinistic. All right, but we got to quit. I'm sorry, we don't have time for more questions.